You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. New from Moultrie Mobile, the Feed Hub offers first-of-its-kind cellular connection and control for nearly any spin cast feeder on the market. When used with the Moultrie Mobile app, you can monitor feed and battery levels, run feeders on demand, receive alerts when feeders are clogged, and remotely adjust feeding times. The Feed Hub is ideal for anyone who maintains feeders. Remove the guesswork and save time by planning feeder maintenance before you drive to your hunting property. For more information, visit MoultrieMobile.com. Mic check, 1, 2, ladies and gentlemen. We're coming semi-live, I guess, from Iowa today. It's hump day, and I'm recording this intro on a Tuesday, and in the background, I can hear tornado sirens going off, and so I'm going to keep this. There's a couple things I got to talk about before. I'm looking at the radar, so I'm safe, but I'm telling you right now, man, some crazy things have happened in the past week. There's a whole bunch of crazy things that have happened. And the thing that I want to talk a little bit about is kids. You've heard me talk about my kids lots of times. So today my daughter had a dentist appointment. She broke, funny story, she broke her braces. And so they were gouging into her cheek. So I had to go to my in-laws or meet my in-laws halfway because my daughter was staying at my in-laws this weekend, and I had to meet them halfway to come pick her up because it was uncomfortable. And I bought a needle nose pliers at a Dollar General, and I ripped another part of her braces out, all right? And in the parking lot of a Casey's, not of all places. And so that's why I had to pick her up from school early today. And I walk into the school to sign her out. And there, you can just hear somebody screaming and yelling as hard as they possibly could in the background. And sure enough, there's some kid just screaming at a teacher, and the teacher is just sitting there and taking it. And I was just had a flashback to back in grade school where teachers could put, they used to be able to put their hands on you. And I mean, I watched teachers back in the day spank kids. I watched a fight break out in high school once where the teacher was trying to break up a fight, and another student basically blindsided him, cheap shot the shit out of him, and punched him right in the face. And then that teacher picked him up, the kid who hit him, picked him up and threw him like a rag doll into the lockers. And like, that was back in the day. And now teachers, they can't do shit, right? Because everybody's afraid of getting sued. And I'll be completely honest, there's a part of me that wanted to walk over and just beat this kid's ass, right? And so, I don't know, like, I look at that kind of behavior, then I look at my own kids, and I'm just like, Jesus, I'm doing something right because everybody else is, I don't know. I wanted to walk over there and intervene, but it took all of my willpower to just pick my daughter up and walk back out of the school. Also, the music that you're listening to now, I have been told by a follower that it sucks balls. And so in the next handful of days or whatever, whenever I get an opportunity, I'm going to be searching for some new music just to make this one guy happy. And hopefully I bring it back. I course correct and I bring it back. So yes, I will be working on the intro and outro music. Outside of that, man, we have a huge show today. And what I mean huge show, We don't, like, in the past couple months, really even this fall, I don't feel like I really have done many strategy deep dives, but today you're going to get one, man. Today we're going to be talking with Nate Roosevelt from the Michigan Wild podcast. Dude, and we talk about everything from crop rotation. We talk about the impact that livestock has on deer patterns. We talk about bedding. We talk about access routes. We talk about trail camera data. We talk about when to strike times a year. We talk about hunting doe groups. We talk about terrain features. I mean, we do a complete scrub of all things big buck hunting strategy, and I absolutely loved it. And so that's what today's episode is all about. I want to send a huge shout out to all of the partners of today's podcast. Huge shout out to Tethered, Wasp, Vortex, Feed Hub, Code Blue Sense, Woodman's Pal, and Huntworth. Please go out and support the companies that support this podcast and really go take a look at it, especially our new partner, Feed Hub. If you are able to run SpinCast feeders in your state, whether that is for additional feeding before and after the season or during the season, if you have the ability to bait or run feeders all year round, go check out Feed Hub. It runs on the Moultrie Mobile. It runs on the Moultrie Mobile app, and so you're able to make adjustments on demand and things like that. So new partner, Feed Hub, go to MoultrieMobile.com, check it out. I have a discount code for Wasp, NFC20, best broadheads on the market. Code Blue Sense, looking forward to that rope-a-dope season, and it's coming up here pretty soon. CodeBlueSense.com, discount code NFC20. Vortex Optics, you can go to EuroOptic.com, enter the discount code 9, the number 9, finger 10, and receive 10% off of all Vortex Optics at EuroOptic.com. And I know Huntworth is going to be running a Mother's or Father's Day sale here pretty soon, so keep an eye out for that. Other than that, man, good vibes in, good vibes out. Let's get to today's episode, all about big bucks. 3, 2, 1. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. Today, I am joined by Nate Roosevelt. Did I say that right?
You got it.
Oh, man.
Winner, awesome. Winner, man. Winner, winner.
That's awesome. he is the host of the Michigan Wild podcast right here on the Sportsman's Empire podcast network. And welcome, my friend.
Well, thank you, Dan. What a pleasure it was to do this with you. First time as being a host for Michigan Wild, but I've been on a couple times in years past. And
yep.
Yeah, always look forward to talking stuff with you. It's been it's usually a highlight of my week or my month. So appreciate you doing that.
Your life must really suck outside of this if I'm the highlight of your month.
Dude, you're like royalty, man. Oh, you've been doing this for a long time. You live in Iowa.
No.
I mean, the only thing you don't got going for you is your football team can't score any points. But, you know, other than that, you got a lot going on.
Hey, I'll tell you what. We scored enough. Well, we didn't score enough points this year, but we scored enough to get to the Big Ten championship game where we got completely destroyed, but you know, is what it is.
I don't know what team destroyed you in the Big Ten championship, but you know, might've been my team up here. So
yeah, let me just say that we got bigger bucks, dude. We got,
yeah,
bigger,
you do.
We got bigger bucks. And at the end of the day, I'm not making arrangements the whole rest of the year to go watch football, right? You know what I mean?
Yes, I got it. You can just update, having updates on your phone while the stand is plenty good enough.
Exactly.
You don't need to watch anything.
Exactly. you just got back from a hog hunt down in Oklahoma. How was that?
Dude, that was fantastic. Like, you know, John with the Oklahoma Outdoorsman podcast, Nick with Huntivore, and Andrew with O2 podcast,
yep.
I believe.
Yep.
We all got to go down there, and I've been on a lot of hunting camps, and I've, you know, do a lot of out of state hunts, but never for some hogs. And John, that was top notch what he had going on over there. That was, I kind of tell everyone, that was the most fun I've had my pants on in a long time. So something just shooting. I mean, though typically when you gun hunt, you know, maybe small game or waterfowl, you might get a couple repetitive shots in, you know, but having an AR with a 30-round mag and a group of pigs in front of you and you can just keep pulling the trigger, that is that's some good stuff. So we all shot some pigs. We got a Nick with a Huntivore. He's all into the wild game stuff. So he knew what was going on. It was the second time going. I was, you know, we rode together and we came back with a truck full of pork. So that's that was pretty cool. He cooked some stuff up when we were there, and I was, you know, for me, you know, being a farm, you know, my dad grew up on a farm. My grandpa still has a farm. I was really around the farm scene as a kid. And then my, you know, my in-laws and my dad now have hobby farms. So like farm life has always been something I get, like, you know, there's a natural order of things, like animals die, like, you know, that kind of stuff. So like for me, seeing these farmers deal with these hogs, it's like, we got to get rid of them, you know, kind of like these things are a nuisance. So they kind of treat them a little differently than, you know, you treat a whitetail or you treat some other, you know, wild game.
Yeah.
So then you have Nick that comes down and he's got a completely different approach. And he's like, this, we can do all these things. And it was really cool seeing that and, you know, being able to take home some of the meat and do something that most people don't do when they, you know, go down there and kill some. But man, I mean, I shot six. So, I mean, I was just loving life. I mean, I got the firing in, using thermals at night. Never have done that before. I've used like night lights for coyote hunting, but thermals, drive around side by side with loaded guns, like just having a good time with a thermal. Like I don't know what more you could want out of a camp. So
absolutely. That's awesome. And the thing about hogs is they're labeled as an invasive species, right? And so the way I look at it is there are certain like ethics, you know, like with a whitetail, you want to make sure a whole bunch of things happen ethically that, so that it expires in the fastest amount of time and you want to do it right. But with an invasive species like hogs, like you just ask anybody and it's just like mow them down, right? Mow them down, get them off the landscape. If you can't find them after you shoot them, I mean, you obviously want to. But if they run into a bush and die, I'm not going to lose sleep over it. You know what I mean? So,
and that's what happened. So, like, I got some cool video of my my massacre, we kind of call it. But, you know, watching back that video and, like, as I was shooting, I was fairly confident I hit a few other critters. You know, like, they were going and I was hitting them. So, you know, I got down and I tried looking for some blood. There's no blood. You know, and then you're the really thick – it's – Oklahoma is a really cool state. Like you have the cattle, you know, ranch, open ground, but then where the fence ends and the neighbor's property is some of the rolling hills, thick, nasty, you know, no trees over probably 12, 15 feet. So, you know, you're trying to look in this terrain, this dry area, and there's no blood. And, you know, I had asked John, I said, hey, what do the neighbors kind of feel like with this? He's like, we don't go on the neighbor. Like, they do not want us on their property, especially to chase, you know, look for a hog. Because it's weird. So, like, farm life, you kind of have tiers of animals. You know, like, whitetail was kind of the mecca. You know, not the mecca, but, like, that was the holy grail. You treat a whitetail and how you harvest or how you kill the whitetail is polar opposite of how you kill pigeons, how you kill rats, how you kill, you know, that kind of thing. So as a kid, like, it was very easy for me to be like, oh, there's tiers of animals to an extent. So like squirrels were, I never really looked highly on squirrels or small game growing up. So now in my adult life, I've kind of done a better job of, you know, when I shoot a goose or shoot some ducks or, you know, the tiers of small game hunting, take way better care of them. You know, like you can, that's really good meat. You can eat that. Growing up, it was like, man, you don't, why eat a rabbit when you have a freezer full of pork or beef that we raise in the farm? So for me, seeing the pigs, I completely relate. Those are a nuisance. Those are no different than the mice that are in your garage peeing and crapping on everything. How you kill them things in a brutal way. I mean, you poison them. You know, put them on traps, they get smashed, they get crushed to death. But because they're so little, it's easier to disconnect from that.
Yeah.
Then you go to a wild hog. I mean, the couple I shot were over 200 pounds. So, like, it's a weird dynamic. And if you're not used to everyday life, it's odd. Yeah. However, you see the damage they do. Like, so me, I'm farm country. Their farm country, their cattle pasture, how that works down south, polar opposite. So when those hogs come in and ruin pasture, it's not like they can just easily get back in there and replant it and have it come up. They destroy everything. Like, they make it rough. they do all that. So it's a cool dynamic. And I think, you know, John was really open to the idea. He was super excited to try some of the pork and learn some of the things that Andrew did and, or sorry, not Andrew, but Nick did. So it was a really good overall experience and I cannot wait to go back.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I wanted to go back so bad, but this year that trip fell on youth turkey season here in Iowa. And so I skipped out on that to take my daughter turkey hunting, which I'm glad I did, but still it would be nice to go and do something like that at some point. So sounds like it was a good trip. Did Nick cooked for you down there?
Yeah. Oh yeah. That dude's talented, man. Oh, like no. He brought some pork from the year before he had shot one. So we ate a bunch of it, but he had some left over. So like the whole time group text, he's like, I got stuff. So we had tenderloin, pork chops, and he made his own bacon and phenomenal. Like as it's sitting there, it kind of has like a venison look to it. It doesn't look like your, you know, commercial pork or even some like we raise pigs here and sell them and eat them. But it looks a little different, but the way the fat still tasted good, like everything he did. And, you know, you got Nick who is, you know, I'm very low, mediocre, like wild game cooking. It's not a skill I have. I can, you know, do things. You got someone like that guy who's very invested in it. But the way he did it, I watched him. I could easily do what he did, you know? So like that was really cool for, he didn't do anything super elaborate. He just wanted to show us, hey, anyone can do this. Here's a couple ways. And it was really good.
And that's why he's on the network. Because he's good at what he does. And so that's awesome, man. I'm glad you had a good trip. When are you going to hit the turkey woods?
So I believe this – I usually get the – Michigan's kind of weird with their seasons. You can apply for certain ones. But where I hunt, we have, like, a lot of leftover tags, and that usually comes either the whole month of May you get. But this year I think you get, like, a few days, maybe it might be April 20th to the end of May. So you have like a lot longer time. So I give myself as much time as I can. Maybe end of April we'll go. Henry, my son, he's 8. He's going to want to shoot. He wants to try to shoot turkey. Yep. But my first time was a triple bearded Tom.
No shit.
I'm that guy that shoots the 160 or 17 Booner buck in this first, you know, I shot a Jake when I was really little. Didn't turkey hunt until I was 18 again. First time out, sat up against a tree, knew turkeys were there, three times came around and picked the biggest one, and it was a giant triple beard. So like a huge spur. So like my turkey hunting, I have yet to shoot a Tom since because I don't really care. I shot a beard at 10 with my bow after that in the fall. Other than that, turkeys haven't been too serious about killing turkeys. So my kid is bringing me back into it though.
I got a question. I'm looking at your video and you got a full strut mount behind you. Is that the triple beard?
That's him right there.
How much did that cost?
Shoot, so I shot it when I was 18 or 19, so that would have been, I'm 33 now, so you guys can do that math. And then I had it in the freezer for quite a while. My mom has got some pretty funny stories about this thing trying to kill her when she opens the freezer because the spurs and the claws. But I think I got it mounted maybe 5-6 years later. And I want to say I was pushing $700 back then. So I'm sure it's, I mean, if you compare whitetail mounts back then to now, it's probably over $1,000. But I'm unsure on that. But I love it. It's a cool memory to have. It's pretty, and my guy did a good job on it.
Yeah. You know, I don't have many I mean, I got a turkey fan. I got a couple of turkey fans. I ended up having to throw a whole bunch away because I'd left them set out and they got, I don't know, something got into them or like I don't know, maybe it's just the cold and then the warm and hot and bad. I don't know. Anyway, I had a whole bunch of them in my house and then I ended up getting rid of them. I threw them away. And so I got to start over on my collection. But I think I want to add a full strut turkey into my collection of taxidermy in the house. I got a little corner in my man cave that would be perfect for a full strut turkey with a little shed antler maybe down on the bottom or one of the arrowheads I found, you know, down on the bottom there. So
for sure.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, I kind of roll the taxidermy here a little bit. I have like my first, I think you can see right over my shoulder. That's my first mallard I shot. That'd be my first Tom. I got my first blue-winged teal over here. First pheasant I shot in North Dakota. first Hungarian partridge. You know, I got my, I don't know if I can really show you, but I have a, I got like a cedar limb with like a pheasant, some partridge, and my bearded hen sitting there. Kind of cool. Cause those are like my first things, you know. My dad kind of was like, hey, your first buck, I'm mounting it for you, no matter what the size is. So like, I kind of always try to do my first, but I have yet to get a pretty coyote. I've shot quite a few of those, and every time I shoot one, they're gross. But I'd love to have like a bobcat or coyote mount to kind of go in with it. Just kind of, you know, seal the deal on all that good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, cool, man. I'm glad you had a fun trip. Glad you're going to get out and take your boy turkey hunting. But we got to talk about some whitetails today, because I posted a image, or, well, I guess more than one image. I think there's like 10 of them. On an Instagram post a while back of, and the whole premise behind this post was that I had forgot about an area. And I don't mean I forgot about it. I just, over the course of the last couple of years, this area on a trail camera basis has not been providing the quality of deer that would convince me to go hunt it. Okay. And so this turkey season, I went out with my daughter. And we went back into this area, and I pulled that trail camera, and I checked the SD cards. And the reason why you reached out to me, because I had some magnums. Some pretty big bucks on trail camera. And, you know, there's that big 10, right? Everybody commented about the big 10-pointer, the typical 10. But there's an 8-pointer who had the broken brow tine. Dude, his neck was ridiculously huge, man. He was a side of beef, man. And so anyway,
and the rubs, you can't glance over those rubs in the back. Just like, I saw those pictures, I think I scrolled through them, like, I was like, how, what is this, you know? Dan Johnson hunting the Mecca of Iowa.
Must be nice. must be nice.
Man, those bucks, whew, those are special, even for Iowa. I've hunted Iowa 2 times. Like, those are special deer for sure.
And so the topic of conversation today, you know, I want to ask you, you know, is going to be about identifying these areas that in the past, you know, like, because everything kind of comes in cycles. Some years are good, some years are bad. You know, deer movement disappears, or maybe it comes back. I don't know. I have my own thoughts on what's going to happen, and we're going to talk about it. But why did that particular post catch your attention, and why did you reach out to me and say, hey, dude, we got to talk about this?
Yeah, so seeing that post, I've, you know, hunting Michigan for all these years, I have a lot of different spots. I got little small permission pieces primarily. I got some family property too, but I'm kind of spread out. I got little properties kind of everywhere. So I have the same kind of thing go on where, you know, you hunt one property 1 year and you see every big deer in that section is going through there on either your trail camera, or you're having sightings, or you shoot that deer that you see in the summer. And then you might go years before it ever reproduces that. And, or I've had the other thing go on where I have cameras around and I go slide into a spot to hunt, and there's all this buck sign with rubs, scrapes. And I'm like, I haven't had a buck on this camera ever. So that when you sent those pictures and talked about it, I was like, I can 100% relate to that, because it's a thing that I think a lot of guys can get hung up on, and it's difficult. And, you know, trail cameras don't tell the whole story to an extent either, but yeah, I shook my head in agreement. I was like, man, I've had the same thing happen. And it's frustrating. And you're like, and then you could go in this fall and hunt that same time frame that you had these pictures, and you might not even, you might all you see is dinks and does or nothing.
Yeah. And I haven't gone back yet and checked, like, I haven't taken a picture, and I haven't gone back to like Wonderground. I don't know if you are familiar with that website, but it allows you to see historical weather events and wind directions and things. So I can put in a date, put in a zip code, and I can say, okay, what was the, the zip code. And I can say, what was the wind doing on this particular day? What was the temperature? What was the, you know, barometric pressure? And basically what that does is it allows me to identify what wind direction had the most activity in front of that trail camera. Okay. And so that tells me, you know, sometimes it's good. sometimes it's like, oh man, yeah, I can definitely get in there. I can definitely see what's going on. Or I got to find another way in, because if it's a, for example, if it's a straight west wind out of that stand, because that trail camera was on a tree that had a tree stand in it. Okay. And so it's also on a property border. And what I mean by that is, it's on kind of a creek. Across the creek is another property. And so I'm going to have to be creative. If that's a west wind, northwest, southwest, any type of westness in that, I'm going to get blown out. And so I got to figure out, you know, if it is a west wind, what do I do? Do I need to move my tree stand further east and try to get them coming on the opposite side of it? But, you know, then at that point, then I'm pulling away from that area of what makes that tree and that tree stand so special. So dive in a little deeper to that, and why, like those problems, and why you think deer go away, and then why do you think they come back?
Yeah, before I do that, have you used that past data with wind direction to your advantage at other properties where it's been like, hey, you this time of year with a west wind, I gotta be here because years past it shows that it's, because for me, I'm trying to think how to word this. Wind direction doesn't really dictate deer movement for me, 100%. So like, I am not if I know an area that a deer is in and he's there, I don't really care. The wind doesn't allow me to like say, oh, I have my west wind, I must go in here now. Mm-hmm. Like I kind of like, well, I mean, obviously, like you said, you have something working against you because of the property line. But for me, it seems more so time of year is way more important than wind direction for when deer are there. But I guess, you know, my brain's rolling like steaming right now. If you know those deer were there and you know it was the west-ish winds, that would make sense why they're coming through there. So you'd be pretty confident on how to hunt that. But I've seen deer do the same thing on multiple different winds. So that's kind of like, I didn't know how you've used that.
Yeah, so for me, what I do is if it's a good spot and I have like 360 access, I'm hunting that spot. All right. Yep. And because I'm mobile half the time or whatever, you know, whatever the case is, I'm not afraid to go set up a tree stand 10 yards away from a tree stand that I already have up. Okay. I'll do that. The issue comes when they're like, for me, I guess kind of going back to your question or to your comment there is I have an area. Right. And I almost have it boiled down to specific tree or area. And I say, is the current wind good for me to access that tree? And when I'm in that tree, my scent blows in a specific direction. Is that going to ruin it for me? Okay. Mm-hmm. Will the access route ruin it for me? And when I'm in the tree, will it ruin it for me? Now, there's times where I get pretty aggressive with my access routes and I'm not really afraid to let a deer that I think is bedded, I don't know, 100, over 100 yards, 200 yards away from me, catch my scent for a brief moment as I'm walking through the woods, okay? Because ultimately what happens, they're catching bad scents in their beds probably all day long. Coyotes, bobcats, whatever the case is, other people walking, they're in that bed for a reason, okay? And so they know that, hey, I smell it now, I'm going to be alerted. Maybe they stand up and they walk away. But my guess is that if it's just the scent, it's not hearing it, it's not seeing it, they'll relax after the course of two more hours, right? I get in, let's say it's an evening hunt and it's late October, sun goes down at 6 or something like that. I'm getting in the woods by 2:30, 3 o'clock. So there's multiple hours that go by where that deer doesn't smell me. Okay. And so that's pretty aggressive. Sometimes it could work. Sometimes it doesn't. Who knows if it works or not. Right. Cause you don't ever see them.
That's the fun.
Yeah, exactly. And so for me, I base it more off, okay, here are the conditions. What do I have control of? I don't have control of the wind direction. I don't have control of the weather. So that kind of, along with the terrain, dictates where I'm going to go set. Like, is it an east wind? Is it a south wind? Whatever the case may be, I pick my locations based off of, can I get in there without spooking them? And while I'm in there, will I spook them? That's how I make my decision.
Yeah, very similar. So yeah, that I like that, because I think sometimes people get sung up on, like, I can only hunt on this west wind. You know, like, I think, and so many variables go into that: wind speed, wind direction, you know, thermals, sun, any cloud. Like, there's too much for me to, like, focus in on that. That my brain's at pretty much full capacity right now, so I try not to go too far into rabbit holes.
Right.
But to kind of lead into, like, I have a buck that I shot this year that really ties into some of this same kind of things we're going through. It was a deer. It was called in the 7-point. 2019, so this is on some permission properties I have. Not big by any means. I mean, sub 20 acres kind of a thing. And this deer had shown up. I had seen him in the summertime, glassing the summer of 19. He was with another 10-point that was substantially smaller body and smaller rack, even though he was a 10. He was just like a nice 2.5-year-old deer, I figured. And I figured the 7-point to be 3.5-year-old. So, like, I'm shooting this deer. Like, that was when I was targeting 3-year-olds. I was up my game. So 19 comes and into season. I was getting trail cam pictures of him. He was doing his thing. Fast forward throughout the year, I believe in 19, I had shot a buck October 4th on a hanging hunt in the morning. Got that deer. So then it was kind of like the only other deer I really had was a 7-point. So fast forward to day after gun season, my brother-in-law had just started hunting. So he was borrowing one of my guns. He had hunted opening day, said, "Hey, I seen a really big deer. Not sure what it was, but it came out somewhere in that area." And I was like, "Oh, I know what I got to do." So I drove back home, went out the next morning, but he had my gun, straight wall cartridge 450. And that morning I was like, I have 12 gauge semi-automatic shotgun, or I have my bow, where I plan on doing a hanging hunt, farthest shot 50 yards. Mm-hmm. And I really debated on what I was going to do. This is a shotgun that I just used for waterfowl hunting. I was like, man, how bad could it be at 50 yards with a slug? Like, I'm just bringing the gun. Mm-hmm. So I grabbed the gun, threw some slugs in, had the right choke tube, and I went and did a hanging hunt. And sure enough, that deer came with the 10-point. You know, this is November 16th, came sneaking through between some bedding areas, and I whiffed at like 46 yards. Like, whiffed as bad as you could whiff. I still don't know. I was so mad about that. I have still yet to ever shoot a slug through that gun, because I don't want to know how bad it is. Because I knew better. I could have shot my bow or my muzzleloader at that point. So I whiffed on this deer, 2019. And he was everything I thought. 3.5-year-old, nice, big 7-point. So keep hunting them all year, never seem to get on them again. Fast forward to 2020, all over trail cam pictures, seen him in the summertime. He was with that same 10-point. Well, opening night with bow season, I shot the 10-point. And then I hunted the rest of the year for the 7-point. Never saw him, got random trail cam pictures of him, but he had a crazy brow tine, so he would leave giant rubs, and they were really gouged. And then his track was huge, like the biggest track I've hunted in Michigan. So I felt like I was really on this deer. 2020 happens, don't get an opportunity, don't see him. 21 comes up, he's still on trail camera, but he's running the same loop, but like not the same kind of a thing, and leaving big sign. So same kind of thing was going on. I would hunt areas that had no trail cam pictures, no deer. I would do like a quick little walkthrough, no sign. 2 weeks later, come in, still no trail cam pictures, big sign. Mm-hmm. Don't know, and it's like different times of year. It's like all over the place.
Yeah.
See him one time on a hanging hunt. I got busted by a group of does. I was up north once again, got a trail cam picture of him. I was like, I need to run back. He's in the area. The trail cam picture was not anywhere where I was hunting, but I had him that like. So with cell cams, I don't do the automatic. I don't get instant data. Mm-hmm. I purposely do it like every 6 hours or every 12 hours, because that's just a personal preference of mine. I don't need to get live action deer movement. I try to I don't care if anyone does. That's just something I choose to do. It saves on battery. It kind of allows me to see how the whole day ended up being, and then I make a decision based on that. Yeah. So I got I was late to the party on the trail cam picture, but I was like, I need to go back there. Bomb home, do a hanging hunt. Doe busted me as I was setting up. Sure enough, I seen a buck behind her, and I was like, I think that was him. He came out 300 yards away that night, bumping does, lip curl, doing all the cool big buck stuff. 22 comes and goes, never get a trail cam picture of that deer. But there was a big sign. So this year, fast forward, I was like, I'm going to hunt it before the sign shows up in this area. Never had a trail cam picture of him. Didn't see him the summer. I shot him October 22nd, bumping two does, lip curl and stuff, and full-on rut kind of action.
Yeah.
So that's a quick story of the 7-point. You know, he was awesome deer, 7.5 years old to 8.5 is what the teeth said. And he big, huge body, low 140s, like just with some trash, just beautiful deer. But all that to say is that I think I messed up a lot because of what you have going on with that spot. He was in pockets, but he would only be in there randomly. Like there was no logic. It was either because it didn't matter if it was beans, it didn't matter if it was corn, time of year. It was like he'd be really hard in this one spot early October, and then he'd be in this other spot late November. Like it was just no, it seemed like no rhyme or reason.
No pattern, so this year, pattern to it.
No pattern that I could distinguish. And so what I learned to do was when I hunted areas, I really focused on just like doing little flybys, like for tracks, for sign, all that. So of the years I chased that deer, I kind of got a little bit of a pattern myself from scouting, not from trail cameras, that this deer liked to move into this little pocket at some point. And if I was there after I saw the rubs, I was too late. Because he was already there and gone. So what I actually used a lot with that deer was I found his tracks. Because for some reason, I don't know if he just figured out trail cameras or what. He did not like my mock scrapes. Once he got to like 5 years old, he stopped hitting my mock scrapes. But he would leave sign. I mean, it was really nice because it was a very distinguishable rub.
Yeah.
Rubs. So yeah, I've adapted the philosophy from chasing some of these deer. Like I need to like, it's hard depending on how much you have, but like, I think the biggest thing to combat this issue is doing some scouting in season, like smartly finding tracks, finding something. And maybe like that spot you have, you might have to get there before you get pictures of them because you might be too late to the party if it's a small window.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where my brain went. And this year it worked great. I shot him October 22nd and I shot another buck November 9th in the same area. And I had no trail cam data of any of those deer when I did it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. A lot to unpack there. I mean, for me, I mean, yes, I agree. What you've said makes a lot of sense. Those big rubs that are in the background of all those pictures, man, once like they don't pop up every single year, but the last couple of years they've popped up, but I don't get, you know, sometimes the pictures are so far back. They're so far back from that, that camera that it doesn't take pictures. The thing that's different about this story is that even hunting the last couple years in that spot were just mediocre. I mean, medium 2-year-old, 3-year-olds at best in that piece. Now, I actually think two things kind of came together, and that's why this particular piece of the property blew up as far as trail camera pictures and mature deer. All right. So in past episodes, I've talked about horses on this property. Okay. And horses eating in the pastures. Back when I started hunting this farm, I think there's 12 or 15 different horses. Over the course from 2007 to today, all of those horses have slowly started dying off. And now there's only one horse left. There's one horse left, and because there's one horse left, that horse isn't using the whole pasture. So they've brought cattle in to this area, okay, to eat the, you know, to take advantage of the pasture. I feel, and this is my experience, deer will work their way through horses, no problem. Mm-hmm. But deer do not like to integrate with cattle whatsoever. Okay. So what it's done is it's kind of shut off a couple of these fingers that run from ag to the river bottom because cattle have access to that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now these deer are using different routes to get to these ag fields. They're not going straight through the pasture anymore because there's cattle there and they just don't want to mess with those cattle. And these doe groups are sticking tighter to the creek in the river and working their way, basically making a big L across another pasture that I don't think has cattle in it anymore and up into this ag. And what it's done is that cattle, those cattle have kind of created a barrier for these deer to work around, along with rotating ag. Because it always seems to me that corn is king until late season, and then they'll go look for beans. Mm-hmm. That's just what I, and so all
year, because we're October 1st openers. So we miss out on that green bean, hunting for the most part.
Yep. And so I'm not sure, if what the taste is for them or the reasons, obviously starches and proteins and things like that, but they're going to the beans later on in the year. Well, the river bottom field was corn this year. Right. Mm. And so their travel pattern stayed closer to the river and still closer to the creek. And that would allow, that's just one theory I have on why I didn't just have more big buck pictures. I had more deer pictures, period, down there. And so it's just one of those things where this now might play into where I spend more time. Because in 2020, I shot a really wide, I think it was 24-inch, real wide 9-pointer. And he was on one of the ridges where the two draws don't come together, but they're about 150, 200 yards apart, but they drop down. So that ridge gets flat and then slowly tapers down to the river bottom. In between there's two ridges. And so the deer travel east-west across that light grade down to the river bottom. And they use those travel corridors of those draws. And so that always used to be good. This year, that also wasn't good, right? Because cattle, they would have had to walk through cattle to get to the high ag instead of flanking it like I feel they did this year. So I look at that and go, oh, shit. Originally, at the beginning of this year, I go, oh, shit, they're running cattle in this pasture again. It's going to change the farm. I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to the big block of timber or whatever. Actually, I believe it's going to help me. I believe it's going to keep deer out of this centralized pasture, and it's going to make them take longer routes on their feet more coming down to this river bottom bedding area. And they're not going to bed as much in the pasture fingers as they will in the river bottom bedding areas. If any of that makes sense.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Because what just happened was all their side cover is now gone because the cows clear that out. There might be some big trees or bushes or whatever. So deer feel comfortable having that side cover. Corn helps. I have a spot that I show you on the map. It's the most beautiful pinch between two sections of woods. If it's corn on both sides, money. Yeah. Money October 1st, money November 1st. Does not matter. It's just the spot to be. If it's beans, if you don't have the right thing going on October 1st with weather, with green bean left, it's nothing. Ghost town. No bucks will be in that area. And I also have a cattle pasture that had cows in it forever, and I ran trail cameras really close to them, and it only have deer at night, like does, button bucks. And there was some nice deer on that camera. Cows haven't been there for a handful of years, and every year it gets better and better and better. So, and then another thing you have going for you, that was a question I was going to ask you, how far away from ag, because here in Michigan, having a high deer density, when you have really good cover right up against ag, your access is so hard because all those deer bed right next to the corn. Yeah. Does not matter time of year for me, until they get bumped a bunch. And I've seen bucks stand up, they're 30 yards off the edge of the ag field. And it's how do you get in there? Mm-hmm. So having that nice buffer now, that distance between, guys talk about it in habitat stuff. a soft edge maybe, or they say some edge. Sort of term, soft edge. So like you want those deer being, you know, 100 yards, 200 yards off your food source, allows you to sneak in, sneak out, all those kind of things. So you have the cattle doing that for you.
Yep.
And now you've got them bunched up into an area you can target. So like how close did you hunt anywhere near this area this year?
I only hunted that farm one time. It was a 2 days in a row weekend. And basically that I'll do that depending on what I get for summer velvet pictures. Okay. And usually I'm not saying every year, but usually I put my mineral out. I'm taking inventory all summer long, right? And I say, okay, here are the shooter deer. What farm are they on? Okay. So in the last couple of years, my new farm that I've gotten access to, that farm has produced some higher quality deer. In the past, I basically put together a little folder on my computer, and I'm like, okay, shooters. You know, I title it shooters for 2024 or whatever. And I'll look through them and I'll say, okay, he's here. He's on this farm. He's on this farm. He's on the other farm. And I'll make a decision on, you know, hey, what deer do I usually go after my number one. Right. And so, mm-hmm. it's based off inventory. Then what I do is I go in mid October or sometime early October to go check trail cameras again. Cause I hunt in a river bottom, and in these river bottoms, there's no cell service. So cell cameras don't work down there. So mm-hmm. I go in and I hunt a day just basically so I can go in there. Like if I'm going to disturb something, I might as well be hunting while I'm doing it. Right. Mm-hmm. So I check a handful of these trail cameras. And then at the end of the day, then it turns into, basically, okay, are they here or not? Okay, if they're nocturnal, typically, if they're nocturnal, that means they're there. If I'm getting trail camera pictures of them, mm-hmm. if they're not there, and them not being on trail camera doesn't mean that they're not there, as everybody knows that. Okay, but what it does is if I have a trail camera in a pinch point or a fence crossing or a major trail or in a popular bedding area or a creek, whatever the case may be. And over the course of 3 or 4 months, they're not on that trail camera. They're not around. That's just what I assume. Okay. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong because I don't have trail cameras covering every inch of the woods. And so then I go, okay, nocturnal pictures don't mean anything to me from a strategy standpoint, except for they're around. Okay. So if they're around, then I need to go hunt said property at some point to attack this. And it just so happened that this past year, the biggest deer on that farm that I had trail camera pictures of, was that 170 class, but based off historical data, he disappears after the first week of October and he goes somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And so I think number one, cattle played their part in him disappearing. I didn't get any pictures of him on trail camera past, I think it was October 12th or whenever that, remember everybody got excited about that, that first cold front that came through. I ate my words. He showed up on trail camera, daylighted. And after that, man, I didn't see him again. So that kind of X'd that whole farm out. And from there on out, it was, other than this river bottom ground that I went to hunt previous to that first week of October, there was nothing to get excited about on that trail camera.
Yeah.
And all the other trail cameras were showing 140 inch 8-pointer, probably a 4-year-old, maybe three. I'm guessing he was a 4-year-old. That's it. That's the oldest buck I had on trail camera on this farm. And so those cattle changed the game. I ignored the property and I went to hunt the other one. And so.
So moral of the story is don't give up if you're in Iowa.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. Well, I'm just kidding. Or, but that is an important thing, because if I had I feel like I have really good trail cam locations. Like, yeah. I'm very confident. Like, if you look at them, it's like, I don't really know where else I can then place these things. But if I had, like, done what you did, mm-hmm. the property I shot both my bucks this year, I wouldn't have never hunted there because yeah. I had the same. But, you know, my property could be completely different set up. Like, you, if you have a pinch or your time of year you're hunting, you know, that's, you know, one of those, you know, scenarios. And you, what also helped is you had another property that was producing. So yeah. really hard to, like, it wasn't like you were just like sitting on the couch not hunting. You were hunting other areas. But for some guys that, you know, maybe are limited on access or they're not seeing what they're seeing, you know, to make them get up and go hunting, you know, you could, I guess my question would be to you, is there a way that you could check that ridge or that terrain feature very like, like not have to like full on blow in there, or you have to like hunt it to check it kind of a thing?
Well, I like to hunt it to check it, but I could always go do some in-season scouting. It's just the matter, I have less time to hunt these days, right?
Yeah.
And so if I'm going to go down there, I might as well hunt. I don't want to drive an hour and a half, 2 hours, or in case of the one farm, 3.5 hours to get yeah. down there and just do a 2 hour scouting mission. Like, yeah. If I'm gonna go, I'm going to hunt, right? I'm taking yep. all my stuff with me, and I'll be impactful on that property at the end of that however many days I, you know, usually it's a Friday night, Saturday night type hunt mm-hmm. early season, and then I'll go check everything out, walk the property, pull cards, you know, make sure everything is set up. For, you know, make sure the battery levels are right so that when prime time comes, right, all I have to do is drop in, check my cams, and start getting aggressive.
Yeah.
Right. So
now you kind of talked about you're doing that in middle October, maybe whatever that time frame is. If your camera is firing, like, doesn't matter if it's nighttime. Like, I agree with you. Like, if I got a nighttime picture of a buck, that does not discourage me. I'm like, he's around.
Yeah.
Do you see carryover from like October into November when you, you know, do your scheduled time off? Like, typically with the mature, because like you hunt. So nice thing about hunting in like other states other than Michigan, there's usually a handful of mature bucks to hunt. Yeah. So I think you guys have a lot more experience with understanding how to hunt a mature buck because you guys have more and you know, here in Michigan, like, it's a big deal to get a buck to be 4.5. So, like, I still feel like I'm kind of behind the eight ball on how to hunt a mature deer because there's just not as many of them. So, for someone like you who, you know, even if it may be a, you know, 4.5, 5.5-year-old 8-point, you're getting pictures of them, you're seeing them on stand. So, you can see a decent buck and understand how he's moving. If I see a deer like that, all attention to kill that one deer.
Yeah.
So, I was just wondering, is there some carryover there on your farms or because
– as far as nocturnal pictures are concerned, the only thing they mean to me is that the deer is there, right? If I go to check trail cameras in April, or not April, excuse me, in October, and, or let's say the trail camera fired at like 2 a.m. or in the middle of the night sometime, and we're talking a long way from sunset or sunrise, that doesn't get me excited. All it tells me is that they're there, but I'm not moving in for the kill unless that's like, you know, 30 minutes throughout close yep. to daylight or maybe even closer. Right. And most of the time, and this is just data that I've picked up from checking trail cameras and spending a lot of time in the tree stand throughout the last, God knows how many years, is big bucks, especially big mature bucks. They do not, like, they just don't go crazy until they need to, right? Most of the time, it's the 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, maybe that crosses over into 4-year-olds that start getting on their feet, you know, in that October 20th time frame. But the big dogs, in my opinion, they're just scent checking. They don't need to go flex their muscles because all they have to do is walk up to a buck that's chasing a doe, tell them, hey, dude, you need to go away. And then they go away. You know, ears back, posture up, tilt the head just a little bit, and there's not even a fight. They flex. Yeah. The little buck goes, I'm not getting my ass kicked today. I'm going to go try to find a different doe. And the big buck can do whatever he wants. in those scenarios. And so that's why I typically don't see them daylight. And when I mean daylight, I mean consistent daylight until the last 27th, 28th, 29th.
Yeah.
You know, even into the first couple weeks, you know, depending on the doe, that, you know, when peak is for them, all the way up until like November 4th, right? That's when the big dogs start going, all right, well, let me, you know, it's like, yeah, let me go put my shoes on and I'll be outside in a little bit, you know, that type of, and then when they get out there, it's like, that's when they're laying sign. That's when you see them going crazy. That's when you see them downwind of does, lip curling, scent checking.
Yep.
That's when they're laying a majority of their sign, and then they go off and feed. They're feeding, they're scent checking, and then they're going to come back probably during dark, depending on the property, right? Wherever they bed, they're going to do a little bit of that going back to bed, and then they're going to sit on their fat ass the entire rest of the day until it starts to get dark, like dark again. And they're going to just do that until they catch their first breedable doe. And then that right there is a kick for them to go bananas. Yep. And even in my experience, big bucks don't even go bananas because they have such an easy time kicking younger bucks off does. They don't need to do anything. They just need to show up basically.
Yep.
And they have what they want.
Yep.
The only time you see a disturbance is two mature bucks in the same area fighting for a handful of does. But in, you know, Michigan, where there's a high concentration of does, in Iowa, where there's a high concentration of does, bucks don't even need to fight that much. If they're fighting, it's because of territory and it's their personality.
Exactly. That you're ringing a bell, because I think that is exactly what this deer was doing for a few years, because he was the only mature one. He was like running his little zones, and he would just move in, take whatever doe he wanted, kick all the other bucks out and lay his sign, because like you said, that was what was going on, and then he would just be gone. And it just, I think it all just depended on when does came into heat and when he moved in. And yeah, I'm sure I got lucky by picking the right time, but I had known that I was spending some time in the zone because he'd been there every year. I just was always behind the eight ball. So now you're telling us all your kind of your strategy and all that. So now you know that this year you had an area where you could have killed a mature buck that you wanted to shoot. How are you like game planning for going into this fall? Like, let's say crop rotations coming to mind, cattle pasture. How are you going to check something like that where it's farther away? That's going to be like, yep, I'm hunting this now. Cause I guess I didn't take that in consideration for you. Cause like some of the properties I hunt are very close. Like I can jet over there and do my thing and be home for dinner kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So you having a property that's farther away, knowing that it was a very killable location for you this year, how are you going to dictate when Dan Johnson's going to be like sitting in that tree October 28th or November 6th? Like, how are you going to handle, like, I guess that's the challenge I think a lot of guys face if they go out of state or if they, you know, have a camp far away, like that kind of thing.
When, like, how do you use that historical data?
Yes. Like, how do you use the historical data to like be efficient with the limited time you do have?
You know, there's always an aspect. Everybody knows this, of luck. Right? You can have a deer show up for 100 days in a row walking in front of a trail camera. The day you go hunt him, he doesn't show up. Right?
Yep.
You know, whether you spooked him or he's like, you know what, I'm going to do something a little different today.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it is, and that's why I choose to hunt when I hunt. That's why I've never killed, I think the very first buck I ever shot, I killed in October, like October 28th. But other than that, it's been November 2nd through the 14th. All my bucks have been killed in that window.
That's crazy to me, because you said that before. I would love to know the statistic of that, because I feel like it's easier to kill bucks in October. To have consistent success in November when it's so sporadic. So like, I think that's crazy. Cause I've had some awesome November hunts, killed bucks in November, but majority of my stuff comes in October, and the rut can be very frustrating.
Yeah.
So I think that's a pretty cool thing. So that's why I'm kind of like picking your brain here, because like you're very effective on taking advantage of when mature bucks are susceptible.
But here's the deal. I don't hunt bucks.
True. Yep.
I'm hunting doe groups. And what do the bucks want? They want does. Yep. Like I don't give a shit about a buck bed.
We need to have that. I need to have that on a poster back here. November, hunt the does.
Don't
look for your target buck. Like, yeah. Because you forget about it. You said it. I'm like, yeah, duh. But like you forget about it when it's that time. Because you're so ingrained to like, where is he? It's like, no, set up on those doe groups.
Yep. And they're going to come through at some point, especially if a doe group meets just the perfect terrain feature or a pinch point. And you just watch, you sit and let's say you hunt every day, October 1st until you kill your deer. If I go in and I watch a doe group come by me within shooting range, I'm jacked about that, because I know that someday there is going to be, especially in this late October timeframe, in the pre-rut timeframe, there's going to be the biggest, baddest buck that is on your property following the first doe that goes into heat. Now, you have to find that right through trail camera pictures. There's multiple doe groups that you got to hunt. Who knows what's up? But one thing you can do is that identify an old big doe. Usually they come in first, usually, right? They're going to be the first to breed. And when you find them and you can get within shooting range of them and they're consistent, then guess what? Then the big dogs are going to be following them at some point. And so, you know, I've also talked 100 times about, you know, the pre-rut being not just stopping November 1st. It happens all the way until on the farms that I hunt, like every doe group's different. One piece of property that I used to hunt, I don't have access to it anymore, was better the third week of November and not the second or first week. I'm a pre-rut hunter and I hunt doe groups in the pre-rut. And so I'm not really looking for buck beds. Sign is okay. It lets me know that they're in here doing something, but I don't need to go crazy looking for them, because what is more consistent than a buck? A doe.
A doe group.
A doe group. A doe. Yes, a doe isn't going, gotta breed. Nope. I'm horned up, testosterone, rage, you know. They're not doing that. They're sitting in a bed. They're standing up to drink, going back to a bed. Standing up to munch, going back to a bed. Standing up, going out all night, eating, coming back to bed. That their pattern doesn't change during the rut for the most part, right? Unless they're getting chased around.
Yeah, pressured or whatever, all that stuff.
And so that's the most consistent thing during the rut is the doe groups. And so why not hunt the most consistent thing?
Yep. 100%.
And so I don't even know if that answered the question or not.
It did for me, like as in your mindset, because like you're obviously talking to you now, I kind of forget there's a little different, you know, approaches and time frames and that kind of stuff. So like, yeah, like hearing you talk about that, I can completely understand why that first farm that you're talking about, that you didn't spend time there this year, because your system, your approach, your process that has worked for you in years past, with certain things that you needed to have aligned to be confident, weren't there.
Yeah.
So like I do the same thing. It's just, there's a couple different tiers for me that I, you know, that are my, and I kind of was hoping when you're going to say, I just have a gut feeling when I got to be somewhere, like kind of a thing. Like that's what, cause I feel like that's all it takes. Like gut feeling, you know, and like spider senses kind of going like tingling. That's the tree I got to be in tonight. And I might have that feeling 8 times a year, and I only shoot one. I might get them one time. You know, that's kind of like how I've looked at that. So hearing you talk about that, I'm like, okay, far away. You like to hunt the doe groups. Yeah. Like, cause for me, I'm like, man, if I had property and all I had to do was just walk around, and I saw the size of those rubs, I'd be like, I'm parking my butt right here.
Yeah.
You know, kind of at least some, you know, something, but I'm in a different circumstance. You know, all my properties are within an hour and a half of me. So that's a whole different ball game. But yeah, that's some good stuff right there. I know we're only in April, but like I'm getting, you know, it's good to be refreshed. And even with me having a great year, you know, shooting, you know, three deer and that kind of a thing, there are certain things you kind of forget about. Like, okay, like then it's good to have that refresher. And I love it. I do.
And that's why, like, my gut plays, and I don't know about you, but my gut plays, it has a role. Like, when do I attack where? It plays a little bit of that. But when I can have a file full of trail camera pictures, and I can go, okay, this buck, last 2 years, he showed up between October 28th and November 7th, this many times on this trail camera, I can say, I'm going to sit in this area, not a particular stand, not a particular tree, because it's wind dependent. What are the thermals doing? You know, we can get into that, into those weeds. But that type of statistics, as far as historical data, play a role. And not just a big deer, like a specific buck, but doe groups. Okay, what are the does doing? Oh, they're coming by at this particular time. They're actually on their feet as well early in the early season too. Okay, all right, let's go. Now, the reason that I pay more attention to the pre-rut over early season is because you can't rattle in the early season. Most of the time, they're not going to come in, right? Grunting and calling isn't that effective early season. It may have some, you know, cause something to come in to investigate. But outside of that, what works, and this is what works for me, is when the bucks are ready to breed, but the does are not ready to breed, is when I have the most luck grunting in a deer or even rattling at a buck that I see. And so you got all these doe groups out there, you know, in a field or working their way by. And then you see a buck kind of working his way off in the distance or coming by, but outside of shooting range, and you hit him with a brap. They look around. They're like, hey, wait a second. If he's doing something, I need to be doing something. And then they come and check, you know, body language and shit like that has a lot to do.
Yeah, don't have fun without me. I want to be over here at this party.
Exactly. Yep. And so, I don't know, man, as far as the topic today, you know, and why this particular piece blew up this year, man, I'm just guessing that the deer now are being forced to use it as opposed to having more travel route options in the past.
Yeah.
And all it's done is just imagine building a subdivision in a certain area. And now they're not going to, if they don't have to, they're not going to walk through a neighborhood. They're going to go around it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of look at it like that.
Yeah, like I hunt in Missouri, you know, a lot of cattle ground in Missouri too before, and that same kind of thing happened. And talking to those guys that hunt that, they'll be like, yeah, you won't see nothing here, but in the rut, you know, they might start coming across these drainages where cows have been. But I don't think it's a very high odds thing, right? Because of that, because like you said, they don't, I mean, my grandpa had a dairy farm, a lot of cows around. Mm-hmm. Very rarely have I ever seen a deer and a cow standing by each other in the daylight. You know, some people might say that it's happened, but like usually they give each other their space. And you know, Missouri, same thing. If we hunted properties that there was cows active there, no deer.
Yeah.
And if cows have been active there and they pull them off, like maybe you get a little bit, but yeah, they don't like to interchange. So I think that's your answer to your riddle right there. Like that would be the thing. And I think I hope you capitalize on that.
Man, I don't
and
know.
Hopefully that deer, both those, you know, those couple of deer, those will be,
what do you
go sneak in there and shoot that one. Whew.
What do you think that 10 pointer was? Booner, like 170?
Yeah. Like my gut's like, he's got so much mass and such good beams and good. I've never shot a 170. You know, I've seen I've seen 170s. I got some good property in Iowa I can hunt. So I've seen them, you know, I've seen some 160s, I've seen 150s, and they get shot and they get scored and they're in the high 150s. that deer popping off the trail. And I had a picture of a 171 in Michigan, and I hunted him for a little bit when I was younger. This deer screams that all day long. Like, no doubt. So he's clean. Oh, man.
His G4s are long. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's it. So anyone can say what they want, but my kind of rule of thumb that I was taught was if you can count 30 inches on tines alone, your booner status. So brow tine, G2, G3, G4. If you get to 30, that deer's pushing 170 or in the 170s. So I think that deer does that. That's for sure.
Who knows what it'll be this year? Shit. Who knows what, who knows what the corn the crop rotation's going to do? Who knows if the cattle are going to be back in there? I'm assuming they will be, but, another shakeup in the area. And it's not necessarily close to my farm, but I wonder if it is going to have a role in not just my farm, but let's say 1 mile, a 1 mile radius around this farm, okay? And that is a major farm in the area that has been managed for deer hunting for several 20 years. It has been sold to a new landowner over the course of the last, and I think within 5 years, it's been sold twice now. Ooh. And so I'm not sure why it was sold, but I'm guessing that they couldn't keep up with what made it great in the first place, meaning planting hundreds of acres of food plots. Okay. And so you have an age class now that is saying, okay, well, maybe there's too many deer on this farm. I'm getting out of here. Maybe the food situation is different now, and they're spreading out. So I'm thinking what's happening is there is some disruption in, I would say, 2 miles of this farm that I hunt, and that disruption is letting deer spread out more. That's a guess. That's an idea. Maybe it's true. Maybe it's not. Maybe this year was a straight up fluke, right? And it doesn't repeat itself next year.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to be putting mineral out this summer to go check. I'm going to be putting trail cameras in to check. Like I'm going to approach this river bottom ground like I do every single year, and I'm going to do my due diligence in trying to track down big bucks, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I have a neighboring property that got a lot of trees cut out of it, a few, and I'm fully anticipating that changing that property because now the neighbors have the cover, better cover.
Yep.
And that could really change a lot of things. It doesn't take much. I mean, think about one tree falling can change the whole dynamic of one area.
Yep.
So I think that's one of those things you got to constantly be involved. And, I've had, I'm in ag areas, but the kind of deer are still pocketed. But if one farm cuts their corn and then the other farm doesn't cut it till a week later, wow, from 4 days, a lot can change. So, I think if you have a guy that's not able to have this like haven for a lot of deer, and they got to spread out, like if they don't have what they need, they're going to go find somewhere else, and hopefully that's your river bottom.
I hope so. It connects. I mean, it's 2 miles away, and it connects by the creek that runs through some of the property that I hunt to the north, and so I'm just like, why not?
I mean, 2 miles is nothing for deer. I mean, nothing. They move. I got properties that are a few miles apart and I'll have the same deer on them.
Yeah.
I'll see them at night in the summertime in one spot. 3 nights later, I'm sitting somewhere else, and then, oh, there's that deer.
Yep.
Found a shed mile and a half apart from each other. Like, they travel a long ways. Your 40 acres is not that big to a whitetail, or whatever you may have. So I do think that's exciting thing about whitetail hunting. Yeah. If you're in a populated area or you're in the middle of nowhere, it's just this game that kind of go. And I think that's why whitetail hunting is so much more fun than turkeys, because you have like all this different stuff going on. People talk about turkeys being very nomadic too, but like You can't go the night before.
Yeah.
On a roost. Oh, they're in the area. Let's go hunt there tomorrow morning. Yeah. Like, you don't really have that in the whitetail game.
No.
So I think that's why I think whitetails have a place in my heart, and the old thunder chickens are just like what I do because I can't chase whitetails.
Yeah. Now, don't get me wrong. You look at some of this mapping data that the Mississippi State University or Auburn University does on tracking deer and deer movement. Yes, there are times throughout the life of a whitetail where it will go on a long journey and come back. Okay. But for the most part, they're not moving very far. Maybe out west, like Kansas, places like that, Nebraska, where there's major distances between food and ag or food and bedding. Yes. But where
and
I
water.
Hunt, in water. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so where I hunt, bedding, food, and water are all within 100 yards of each other all the time. And so, yeah, they might run a little circuit. They might walk, be on their feet for miles at a time, but it's miles walking in circles.
Yes.
You know what I mean? I just don't think, especially on the farms that I hunt, I can only talk for what I see. I just don't think deer are moving as much as we think they're moving, right?
That's why habitat is so important. Like, if you go, anyone who, I've hunted out of state for like 12 years, public land, private land, you know, lease property. If you do not have good habitat, it makes it so much more hard, like difficult on public land. Those deer move. If you find the area that's got those things, you will have much more better hunt. You know, that's very cliche, but I hunted in Southern Illinois this year, and I just learned so much more about how deer move throughout areas and how maybe weather can kind of affect that to a different extreme because of the vastness of it.
Yep.
I mean, I still found signs, still found, saw a big deer that I wanted to shoot, you know, driving around the truck scouting. But the amount of, like, if I am in Michigan and it's November and I catch a buck with a doe the night before in the pocket, and then I go sneak in that pocket the next day to hunt, and I walk the entire thing, don't bump another deer, don't even see any sign, don't bump that deer, that thing's gone. Like, and it's because it's just not good habitat. I literally walked miles in not good habitat. Michigan, you find a buck with a doe, it's like if there's thick cover, he's kind of hanging out in that area, you know, not moving. There's a lot to this game. And if you have the three things, go out there and have fun, kill them.
Yes, sir. Well, we've been chatting now for a while, Nate. Man, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to hop on and talk turkeys with us. Or turkeys, Jesus, who cares? Like,
A little bit of turkeys.
Yeah, I mean, talk deer hunting, strategy, all that good stuff that we obsess about all the time. So thank you, and we'll be in touch again before the season starts. But, man, if not, which we will, man, good luck. And good luck with turkey and your boy, and good luck with you shooting a Michigan Magnum.
Thank you. Hey, I appreciate you having me on. And, you know, I didn't say this in the beginning, but you are known as a nine-finger death punch to the Roosevelt household. So I think that might be something you haven't been taking advantage of. But, you're nine-finger death punch. So I appreciate you letting me do this. It's been fun. I kind of came into this conversation kind of thinking one way with how I would handle what you were given. And, you know, hearing your side of the story. And, I mean, there's two polar opposite things that we just talked about. So I think that's, you know, you got to find your system and your process, and you can hear a guy like me talk about how I've handled it. Mm-hmm. And now I got your perspective, and tell you what, if I go out of state in a November hunt, those are some of those things I probably should do a little better job of, maybe listening back to how you hunt those deer in those areas. So that's why podcasting's so cool, man. I mean, I've been doing the Michigan Wild thing, I think, since July of last year. Love talking to a lot of different people, learned a lot of different things. And this is why I got hooked on podcasts. So it's kind of cool to be able to talk about it and do these things. It's been awesome. And thank you, Dan. Hopefully you smash one of that. If you get that typical 10, dude, woo, man.
We'll see, man. We will see. I don't like to count my chickens before they hatch, but if he does, let's just say this. If he does the same thing that he did this past year, he might be in trouble. So, but
awesome.
You know, he could get hit by a car too. So who knows? Who knows?
Yep. Or he comes walking in with just the brow tying and no
exactly. The everything's busted off. Everything's mm-hmm. busted off. If you guys want to go and listen to Nate over there at the Michigan Wild Podcast, excellent, excellent episodes, especially for guys who are from Michigan. And even if you just like good outdoors content, he kind of covers it all. Make sure you go to iTunes, Spotify, or even the Sportsman's Empire website and check out Michigan Wild. It's a good podcast. And again, Nate, thank you. And we'll talk to you when we talk to you.
Yes, sir.